Hello and welcome to The Thing About Cars. This is Mickey Desai, your host, around the table. It's a small crew today because it's the new year. Don, are you there?
I am here. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Don. Dave, you with us?
I am here. Happy New Year to all.
Absolutely. And lastly, Ben. How are you, Ben?
Yeah, I'm here.
Excellent.
I am here, and it is a Happy New Year so far.
It's just a small crew today. It's the beginning of the year. We're all hanging out, just having coffee and mimosas, and I already had my brunch. Did you guys eat already?
Yeah.
No.
Why let brunch get in the way of a good mimosa?
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, and we stayed up really late playing dominoes. So yeah,
dominoes. That's cool. Mexican train, I think, is it?
Yes.
Called,
yes.
Yes. It's been a long time since I've done that. So let's just jump right into our agenda. We've got a pretty quick agenda for today. I've got Grand Trivia Auto. So my cat wants a piece of that action. Here we go. The question for Grand Trivia Auto is, if you have a truck and you put on the iron, what have you done? Have you put chains on the tires? Have you put the gas pedal on the floor, like stomped it? Have you stopped for coffee, or have you hitched up another trailer? I'll repeat those choices again. If you put on the iron, have you hitched up another trailer? Have you stopped for coffee? Have you stomped the gas pedal to the floor? Or have you put chains on the tires? And we'll come back to that. I think that's an excellent winter question.
That is a good one.
Yeah. Oh. So that's Grand Trivia Auto. The our first segment for this episode is that new car smell. Ben, what have you got for that new car smell today?
Well, I'm going to start off with Cadillac. There's something interesting going on with them. basically, they have made a decision that by 2030, they want most of their vehicles to be electric. I don't know how it's really going to break up between all electric and hybrid and plug-in and things like that. But they've decided to make a big commitment about this, and I think a lot of people knew that already. But this is causing a little bit of a problem with their dealers because, all the dealers have to make some investments to be able to carry these cars. And they're not only going to need charging facilities, but they're also going to need some tooling and training, various things like that. And this has caused a bit of a problem among their dealers. Now, keep in mind, for those who don't know, new car dealers are independent businesses. They are franchises. They're not part of General Motors or Ford or whatever. They're people who, just like McDonald's, have paid some big bucks to have a major branded business. So they have to make these investments. Of course, as a franchisee, you have a contract with the larger company who you're representing, or an agreement of some form. And so a lot of them are balking at what it's going to cost to prepare for this future, which I think I read was about $200,000 a piece, or per dealer. And as a result, about one out of six Cadillac dealers have decided to opt out. And GM, because they have agreements with GM, GM is offering them a buyout. And the amount of the buyout depends on the amount of sales the dealer does. I read they're ranging from about $130,000 to over $1 million. But one out of six Cadillac dealers are going away because they don't want to invest in this.
And so, is that going to be just cars or their SUV line?
Well, yeah, it's both, because they're you get both at a Cadillac dealer, yeah. But the everything I've read about their electric future says 30% of cars and SUVs, yeah, not 30% by 2030. I'm sorry.
That's really not a lot of time to take out a sixth of your sales capacity.
Yeah, well, there are about 450. Cadillac dealers in the United States, I believe. Take out a sixth of those. You've still got some distribution, but it's not a brand that's exactly on fire right now anyway.
No, you're right. It's not. And, General Motors has, from time to time pushed back against the franchise model. That was the whole idea with launching the Saturn line, was to try to get to direct distribution. And it's just because I think the dealers had so much lobbying power that, the model never took off.
You say lobbying power, it's important to keep in mind that many states prohibit direct sales from the manufacturers. So,
yeah.
course, my snarky response to that is, yay, freedom.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what do you think is going to happen, Ben? I mean, certainly well, this is not setting the stage for Cadillac to go away.
No, not at all. I think they're going to stick around. I think the ones who do stick with the program are probably going to, well, I was going to say they're probably going to do okay. This course really depends on what the product winds up being like.
Yeah.
You know, whether the car is something people want. Because remember, a few years ago, I don't remember what it was called. I didn't have time to look it up, but 5-6 years ago, I think Cadillac came out with a hybrid car that was basically a Chevy Volt that was all, you know, dolled up as a Cadillac, essentially. I mean, the body shape was a little bit different, but the platform, everything under the skin was a Chevy Volt. And the thing was a flop because I think everybody realized they can get just as good a car for a lot less money if they buy it from the bow tie. But things are changing a little bit. Electric's got a little more cachet now. I think it's a little more recognized as the way the future is going to go. So as long as Cadillac can produce something we want, I think the dealers who stay on board are going to be all right.
Yep.
And losing a few dealers doesn't hurt as far as, you know, spinning a little exclusivity. They've always been a luxury brand anyway. So,
So what we're really saying is that the Cadillac should feel free to contact us for our design influences. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, it would be because my husband wants a Cadillac, and I'm not a Cadillac fan.
I've driven a couple of, not real recently, but maybe 2-3 years ago, I drove a couple of them as rental cars on my business trips, and they were okay, but I've got some suggestions. There are a couple of things about them that kind of bugged me.
Do they have a lot of fleet vehicles?
Not really, not beyond what's in rental cars. And even then you don't see them all the time.
No, you don't. And actually they have not been the favorite of corporate fleets for probably 15, 20 years. You know, there was a point in my career where I had the automotive program for the company rolling up in the supply chain department I was running. And up until that point, we had been a Buy American only company. And brand new slate of senior vice presidents came in and said, yeah, we're a world-class company. You know, there's no, you know, I'm not going to trade in, you know, my Audi or my Tesla for, you know, your daddy's, you know, caddy.
Right.
Well, I mean, the other argument there is too, that even if you buy foreign in this country, it's still putting money into Americans' pockets when you do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Interesting. So yeah, when I've only rented a Cadillac for an extended period of time once in my life, and I was very much impressed. It was smooth. It was large. It was the first time I'd ever had seats that were both heated and cooled. And that summer day, that made me very happy.
I mean, they're good overall. I just had, you know, of course, every car I drive, I've got my share of niggles with.
So. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Well, cool. Thank you, Ben. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Let's switch gears here, and this would be the area where we have a guest, but we don't have a guest for today since we're just taking it easy. But if any listener out there wants to be a guest or knows of someone that we should reach out to, please drop us a line via our Facebook page. I think that's simply facebook.com/thethingaboutcars. But if you just search for The Thing About Cars on Facebook, you'll find us. And we'd love to talk to you and hear your suggestions. In our next segment, we're going to start within the news. I think Don's got something for us. Go ahead, Don.
I do. And, you know, this is the time of year where we're looking to the future. And I saw that Ford's prognosticist, futurist, Cheryl Connelly, had 7 predictions for 2021. Some of them around cars, some of them just around things. And they took a survey, 14 countries, and, you know, kind of analyzed some responses from people. One of the things that was the overall trend was that a lot of people feel like it's going to take a good 2 years to return to normal. Although 8% said that never will be normal again. You know, we use that word new normal. So her 7 real more specific predictions are that there's just going to be still a lot of high anxiety worldwide. Said that 63% of adults globally say they feel more stressed than they did a year ago. And 4 out of 5 said they needed to take better care of their emotional well-being, which led into her second prediction. So as people are still really stressed out and anxiety ridden, she's feeling like there's going to be people that want to just time for escape. A lot of folks, one in five say they use their vehicle for to find privacy. So they're seeking out vehicles. They want to find ways to escape, and they're using their vehicle. One in four are using their vehicles to relax. I hope that people are getting in their cars and just kind of driving around the lake or around the block or whatever. So it's surprisingly 17% say they use their car to work. I bet people are just grabbing their laptops, heading out to their vehicle, putting on the tunes and just working, I guess.
I watch that happen every day because my desk in my office faces out into the street, and the two houses across the street have between them like a bajillion little kids. And every once in a while, I will watch one of the parents go out and just sit in their car in front of the house and have a Zoom meeting at the steering wheel and it's funny because they're better cars and you can see the kids wandering around trying to get their attention, and it's like, you know, nice soundproof cabin it's a good professional escapism, at least in Virginia Highland.
I think that prediction is already coming true, and her study bore that out.
There's a market for in-car office stuff that I've seen. A laptop desk that basically attaches to your steering wheel, and I've met virtually online, I've met a handful of podcasters who record their podcasts in their car. So
wow.
Yeah, the acoustics are, pretty dead in most cars. And I know of one vehicle way back before any of this ever started that actually was designed with a little bit of office capability in mind. And that is the Nissan NV series work trucks.
Oh, yeah. And,
yeah, you remember those came out about 10 years ago, and they sold them in various different, styles. You could get a high roof, a low roof, and all these optional features. And they knew that self-employed or small business type, contractor, handyman, whatever kind of people were going to be a large market for it. So they actually built the interior to have some kind of, office useful features. Like the passenger seat could fold down into like a desk sort of thing.
Yeah.
Had little compartments for pencils, places to plug things in, all that good stuff. Because they knew that if you're a self-employed, handy guy, you're doing a lot of business in your vehicle. You're taking phone calls, writing things down, stuff like that.
Yeah, sales on the road. I think Ford had come out with one of those also. I'm trying to remember the brand.
There's a minivan where the front was to be, the driver was allegedly supposed to be your secretary, receptionist, and the person would sit in the back at an actual desk with a phone set up and the office was literally set up in the back of the thing. It was like a miniature RV, but it was an office set up in a minivan. I just thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah. If you look up, I forget what it was actually called, but there's a Swiss car designer named Franco Sbarro, spelled like the pizza joint, who has done a lot of interesting work over the decades. And somewhere in the 70s, he did a thing where he took a mid-70s Cadillac Eldorado and put like a big van kind of body on the back of it. And it's got a table and chairs. It's basically a mobile office, and it was built for a Middle Eastern oil guy. Don't know how much use it got. That said, if you also look back into the late 40s, 1950s, some of the American car companies had what they called, I'm a little foggy in the term, sales coupe or something, but they were basically two-door cars with no back seat, designed for traveling salesmen to carry a certain, not huge amount of inventory with them.
Right.
Oh, it's the Ford Transit that I was thinking
That's
of.
It.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That, and very handy.
Very, very handy. And you could do a lot of modifications on the inside to have shelving and bins and some really cool things. So the third item that she is prognosticating on is who you keep company with. And, so many people are reshaping their families. They're talking about, we talk a lot about your little pods or your, who are you? What's the word I'm looking for? quarantining with. Yeah. You know, your bubble. That's the word I was looking for. Who's in your bubble? So there's, you know, younger folks, Gen Zers are really feeling lonely, you know, and so they're thinking about, you know, moving either closer to family and what that means online and offline. So that's kind of a trend that they're seeing, is how we shape our families and who's our family, and how we protect our, you know, our seniors in life so that they're with us longer. So people have their bubble with various other families. There's also an interesting prediction about minding the gap. And that's a lot of inequity and inequality that, you know, as we saw this year, a lot of unrest and how disproportionate this pandemic has been on low income families and low income individuals. So 76% of adults globally say they expect brands to take on a stand on social issues. And I think that alludes to what Ben was talking about with the Cadillac going EV. You know, brands are thinking, are they doing the right thing? And that's a lot of brands that they surveyed are really looking for that, and what they're buying and how they're passing that on to consumers.
I've been seeing that with my clients. There's this growing sense of skepticism that government is ever going to solve anything, and a recognition that, you know, if you've got enough economic clout, like a Fortune 500 company, that, you know, instead of waiting for government to solve it, like, fine, we'll set a standard. And if it becomes the Wild West, you force government to address the issue.
Right. And, you know, and part of that leads into, they want good buys, and they, people don't, 41% are saying they don't want to go back to the shopping the way they did before the pandemic. I posted something on Facebook the other day comparing, like, my Amazon packages under the tree to, you know, pre-wrapping. And I would say 80% were shipped from somewhere. They, you know, wasn't buying in a store. And surprisingly, you know, venturing out a little bit, driving around, a lot of things are closing. Restaurants just have it reopened. So a lot of that. And then her last two, you know, kind of flow from all of this. One is traffic detour. Bike sales have really soared, especially in cities. You know, I know there's a lot of those people that are using the rental type things where you just pay for using a scooter or a bike short distance, or even a car in cities. But car sales have boomed and bike sales have boomed, and people are looking to control their environment. And the last thing that they're seeing is a sustainability. You know, how do we really look at making sure that we diminish our disposables, our, you know, do recycling, have energy efficiency? And 46% of Gen Zers globally say the pandemic they see is more wasteful because people are doing takeout and they're using straws and using throwaway containers. So how can they look at impacting the long-term environmental integrity from the pandemic?
So I just want to point out that everything you're talking about has been addressed from a marketing point of view, irrespective of politics.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so her, you know, her prediction is cars will be doing really well. And although, you know, none of us are a Nostradamus, we'll see where we are this time next year. And we'll see how this, you know, things continue to be shaped, how we see that people spend their time and where cars make a difference. I think will be, you know, up and coming. So
Very
that's,
cool.
That's what I'm seeing in the news.
Thank you, Dawn. You know, you said something in the beginning where the new normal, people preferred a new normal. And part of me doesn't want to go back to normal, right? I mean, that's why I like the term new normal. Part of me wants to take the lessons we've learned moving forward from here and actually make things better. And as much as I love driving, I don't like commuting to work. So I'm hoping that the working world doesn't mandate that everyone has to now return to the office if immunity actually, you know, does what we hope it does.
So. Well, you know, and it usually takes tipping points to really move the needle. I mean, slow, methodical incrementalism is, you know, is the norm. And when you have major change, it usually takes something cataclysmic to make change happen. Change is not welcome, unless you are forced into it.
Right. I agree with you. I wrote something the other day that if I never see the inside of a conference room again, I'll be just fine with it. But one of my clients and I are going to have a meeting tomorrow, and we're essentially meeting on the Beltline and having our meeting while we're walking outside. And I'm like, that just doesn't suck in terms of a quality of life.
Well, I also think of the British monarch. She is infamous for taking walks with heads of state and dignitaries and her own staff to work things out. And I think that may be the beauty of the Beltline or other walking zones around the world, is that we do need to get kind of think on our feet.
She also drinks gin and Dubonnet at lunch. So I think she's a role model all the way around.
And she drives Land Rovers.
By herself. Yeah, she gets behind the wheel and gets going.
There was also a Jaguar that used to belong to her that was for sale five, 6 years ago or something. It's just one of the several cars she gets driven around in. And I thought it was interesting that among the custom features in it, and there weren't that many, but one of them was a special shelf that basically kind of was a rearward projection of the armrest between the front seats, this little shelf that stuck into the rear compartment to put her handbag on.
Oh, I wonder what's in that handbag.
I don't know. And then right by the shelf, there were four little buttons that sent the driver various signals so that she wouldn't have to say, excuse me.
I said, I always thought besides lipstick, they were UK's nuclear codes.
There is actually, if you look on the internet, you will find an article about the Queen's handbag. And honestly, there's not much in there. It's like Kleenex and
lipstick.
Gloves, like a rain scarf. But the thing that is so pertinent about it is she uses the handbag to signal her staff.
Yeah.
And if she is stuck talking to somebody, she will move the handbag from one hand to the other. And that's the sign to her handlers, get me away from this twit.
But this car I thought was cool because it was for sale and it was not that much money either. And this was like a less than 10-year-old Jaguar, and they wanted something like £12,000 for it. That would be a cool thing to have.
It really would be. One of the things I little bit of a monarchist here, because my mother's family's English. The Queen, because in World War II, she trained as a WAC and she trained as a driver and an auto mechanic. She's got this incredible motoring history, and really also hates being driven around. Like when she's in Balmoral, she will always, be out in the Land Rovers driving all over the countryside, and you'll invariably see pictures of Charles or Philip or somebody else sitting next to her looking positively miserable that they're not in control.
Don't forget, too, Philip has some engineering background, and I saw a thing once where some show about him where he was proudly showing off this mobile picnic rig that he built in the back of one of the Land Rovers or one of the vehicles. He had installed all these little drawers and compartments. There was a place for everything they'd need to have a grand royal picnic out in the countryside. He was so proud of that. I thought, that is really cool.
I wonder how many cars she's demoed. Because she is a driver, so kind of cool.
Neat. I'm sure there's a certain amount of prestige for any car seller to have the Queen behind the wheel of one of their creations.
Oh, yeah.
But, So, thank you, Dawn. Good stuff. Dave, you had some news for us, too, right?
Yeah, building off of this, talking about trendsetting and environment, I don't know if you all had seen, first of all, last year, coming in 2021, Jeep has announced that they're building essentially a hybrid Wrangler, the Jeep 4XE. It's coming in supposedly in the first quarter of 21, which has just totally hijacked my car buying plans until I can actually go see it. But there was an article that came out late this week about Jeep and Fiat that really caught my attention. Basically, the Fiat Chrysler Automobile Company, or FCA, just announced plans to upgrade its Tiszy Poland factory to build three models of Jeep, Fiat, and Alfa Romeo for the second half of 2022. And they haven't announced what models there are, but there's a lot of speculation out there. One of which says that, you know, this could be Alfa Romeo's upcoming city-sized SUV.
Interesting.
In the press release, though, by the group's Polish arm, FCA confirmed plans to, quote, expand and modernize this facility in order to start mass producing the first three passenger car groups in the second half of 2022. And the cars are technologically advanced models based on a new concept of mobility. They'll be manufacturing in the most advanced drive systems, including all electric drive. And hybrid powertrains. And as they were talking about some of the different cars that could be going in there, they didn't talk about the models. They said basically that they think these are really being focused on competing with city-sized SUVs like the Toyota Yaris Cross and Ford Puma and the Audi, which, you know, basically are mostly European cars, and B-size SUVs, but all heavily focused on offering battery electric variants in the small crossover range. So back to, you know, something that I brought up when I first came on the show, there's a lot of really great hybrid and electric sedans out there, but there are, you know, if you're more motivated by the fun of driving, there's not a lot out there. And it sounds like they're going full bore into producing some of the more bespoke models, like the Fiat 500e, in a hybrid format. So that could be really exciting, and that could, to Don's point, really, you know, focus on a company leading change that government has hesitant to mandate.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Dave, when are these models expected to hit America?
They actually, you know, since they won't even start producing until probably 2021 and hitting the market in late 2022, I don't think we will probably see them here to 2024 or 2025.
Right.
But one of the nice things that I've observed about Fiat Chrysler working together is they've become really good at injecting ideas quickly into each other's native country production chain, much more than what I had seen with Ford or GM. Even Toyota is not always that quick at introducing innovations in one market into another one. Fiat and Chrysler seem to be really cracking that nut of injecting creativity and ingenuity across corporate cultures, across national cultures.
Yeah. Interesting. It makes me wonder what the barriers are to spreading that innovation. Is it a conscious choice by the car manufacturer to do a release in one continent and then hit the other one, or is it government interference? What is it?
You know, a lot of it, a big portion of my career, the end of my corporate career, was working across cultures. I helped Delta set up SkyTeam with all of the different airline partners that are in that. And, you know, that is UN grade diplomacy. When we started out SkyTeam, I used to say that the corporate motto of Air France should be this is not possible. And for Alitalia, we introduced the concept of Mediterranean Standard Time, which says that you will actually leave for your destination at the time you committed to be there.
That's hilarious.
So it was not a SkyTeam meeting until, everyone sat around for an hour and a half waiting for Alitalia's management to get there. And then immediately the meeting could not begin because everyone had to have a cigarette and a cup of coffee.
And while the Germans sat around tapping their fingers,
if you're on time,
you're already late.
That's right. Yes. German and Dutch are pissed off that we're late. The French have already, you know, compiled their list of objections, and the Koreans are still busy, you know, trying to decide, should I be wearing a necktie or should I not be wearing a necktie? But yeah, that kind of cultural barrierism impacts marketing and what works really well in marketing something in Italy, and that could be cars or coffee makers, doesn't necessarily translate into an American culture and even within America. Our markets are far from monolithic.
And back to Fiat Chrysler, I think there's one thing they really, really need to do. That's bring out a convertible Challenger.
Yes. Ooh, yes. Yes.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes, that would be the thing to do.
Absolutely.
Again, so what you're saying, Ben, is that Fiat Chrysler needs to come to us for our design influences. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Very cool. I've got some ideas for this thing.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
I mean, we own the hardtop one, so I've been taking notes.
Very cool. Anything else, Dave? Don?
I think that's it for my end, my corner of the world.
Thank you.
I think we'll just have to see how 2021 unfolds. And unlike 2020, I went into it having all these grand goals and plans. I think we're going to have to wait and see what 21 brings. Yeah. I think we're all cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, cautiously optimistic is definitely the phrase of the day, of the month, of the year. But thank you. I'm also cautiously optimistic.
I want to make an observation. So being the newest member of the show, I really loved doing this. We've also started doing it on Zoom with cameras on. And so what all of you listening to us are missing is the cavalcade of cats going and flying through the screens of my compatriots. I'm pretty sure what Don has taught one of them to mix mimosas.
He just keeps pre-filling my drink. Exactly. Bentley is just, he keeps going and he's the luxury cat. So absolutely. Oh, yeah.
The funny thing is I never used to be a cat person, and I'm still not saying that I am a cat person, but my wife has a pretty cool cat. So I call him mine now. So I guess I've become a cat person. But.
Yes. Well, Lamborghini and Ferrari are taking their mid-afternoon naps right now before they wreak havoc across the house.
Mine is sitting right here at my feet, keeping an eye on me. So,
that's what they do.
That's what he does.
And one of mine is in the adjacent chair here, too. So,
all right. We got to get Dave a cat.
We got to get Dave.
Silence. It's literally silence.
I accidentally hit mute. So, when my partner and I got together 29 years ago, he arrived in the relationship with a long-haired, part calico, part Mancoon. It was 18-pound long-haired cat. It looked like an Ottoman with a face. And that cat never ceased to ensure that I understood I was the interloper. Even though the cat moved into my house, I was the trespasser in the relationship. And when an 18-pound cat jumps onto your bed in the middle of the night, it's a little bit like getting hit by a meteor.
Yes, it is. Even a 15 pounder.
That's too funny. All right, let's switch gears a little bit here and do a quick note of viewer mail or listener mail as it is. Our friend Robert Drake says, "Hi folks, I had an interesting situation occur tonight. I gave someone a jump and they both wanted to put their let me make sure I'm saying this correctly. I'm not sure he's punctuated it well here. He says, I gave someone a jump and they both wanted to put their negative terminal on the battery and not on the ground. And their battery was not well labeled. So when they guessed which terminal was negative, they were wrong. Why do battery makers make the positive and negative terminals so hard to distinguish from each other? And why don't more companies make a ground tab on the car to the block so it's easier to jump the car?
Well, for the batteries, I think it's mostly a matter of not wanting to spend any more money on the design than they have to. Anybody should be looking and visually paying attention. What would it cost to put a little paint mark on top of that little raised plus or minus symbol? Well, probably more than we think.
Right.
The paint itself doesn't cost that much, but the production capacity to put it there.
Well, why not just change? Sorry, Dan.
The tooling. Now the tool and dying. I don't think people think about how people can take care of their own cars and jump their own cars. And I think some of that stuff just gets lost.
So let the car manufacturer do it. How hard can it be to put a tub in inside the engine compartment somewhere that's de-ground, right?
I've never had trouble finding a spot to connect, you know, a ground in there.
Yes, but you are not the average car driver, Ben.
This is true. But on the other hand, there's that little minimum education gap. You know, you shouldn't be jumping the car unless you actually know how.
True.
Same with changing a tire. Same with driving the car.
Right.
Yeah. My convertible is just got a new battery for it, and I'm just not driving it enough because the top is down all the time. And so the battery's dead. And Chris and I will argue every single time about where to put the grounding cable and who gets both cables and who doesn't get both cables. I pull up my iPhone. I'm like, here are the rules of how you jump a vehicle. So, you know, that's the other thing is I think everybody can Google, you know, how do you jump a vehicle? How do you change a tire?
Or for that matter, put, you know, lack of a better term, eliminated flight safety card underneath the hood. Say, if you're to jump, do it this way.
Right.
Yes. I like that idea. There are many, I think, inexpensive ways to give people a nudge.
So Ben, do an instructional quick one on how you jump a car.
There's an idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an easy thing to put together, but you know, and I get it. You wouldn't want to retool the entire manufacturing process for making a battery. Like, for instance, I thought maybe you could make one post round and the other post square, but that of course means redesigning a post and manufacturing that post.
And they have to agree on which one it is, the positive or the negative.
Right.
So
all the manufacturers would have to get together independently and say, we're going to do the positive will be round and the negative.
It sounds simple, but by the time you get through what's actually involved in making that kind of change, it's like a moon mission.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. But okay, so let me back it up a step then. What if we can universally agree that the plastic cap on top of every battery, the red corner is positive? We could just put one, because they segment them anyway, right, in pieces sometimes. Why can't the corner that's positive be made out of red plastic from that one?
You know, I always thought it was, because when you have the jump cables, there's red and black. But the deal is, as long as you connect red to red and black to black, positive to positive, negative to ground, then you're fine. So but
that's not there on every battery.
It's not on every battery.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Because then you're getting into making more plastic pieces.
Yeah.
And I work in the plastics industry. Believe me, it's not a trifling thing to, make new plastic parts.
Right. So then the last thing is the existence of some of these jumper cables that actually tell you if you've wired your car up correctly. There's a little box or an indicator somewhere on the cable between the two cars that will tell you if you've cross polarity or if you're matching polarity. And that's not a bad thing to have, I think.
No, it's not. Obviously a difficult, electronic thing to do. It's just a matter of having a diode and an indicator light.
Right.
Yeah. Diode to protect your reverse current. But of course, it is a little extra money.
Sure.
It's a little extra money. And it's not one of those things. That's not one of those spontaneous purchases. Right. My jumper cables are in my Jeep are the same jumper cables my father gave me when I bought my first car in 1984.
Very cool. Oh, yeah.
They don't typically wear out unless you connect them wrong and blow them up.
But I have seen another device that basically connects a cigarette lighter to a cigarette lighter opening. And that's apparently a way that people can get current from one car to another. I've never seen one work. I've never seen one at work, rather. So I don't know if they're effective or not. But that seems like a pretty foolproof way to avoid polarity switches.
It's nowhere near enough juice for jump starting.
Yeah, it's not.
I can't imagine it would be. Yeah.
If they're both parked there for several hours, you may see a little boost in your battery. But
yeah, it's like using a trickle charger.
You can't get
the voltage and amperage through that small of a cable.
Right.
And that small of a receptacle.
Right. So I hope this answers Robert's question. Robert, if it doesn't, please write to us or call us or whatever.
Regardless, thanks, Robert. It was an amusing topic.
It's a good start.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Good topic for sure.
And, mm-hmm. And definitely, and WikiHow has a definite, like, they have a really nice step-by-step checking the battery, charging the battery, jumping the battery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that hard, right? It's not rocket science. You just have to be aware of what you're doing.
Well, and you also have to, like my husband and I do, not argue over which is positive and which is negative.
Yeah, right.
I push him out of the way and say, let me do this.
Yes, winning an argument with Don may actually be more difficult than rocket science.
All right, let's close out the episode with our grand trivia auto question of the day. The question was, if you have a truck and you, quote, put on the iron, what have you done? Have you stomped the gas to the floor? Have you stopped for coffee? Have you put chains on the tires? Or have you hitched up another trailer? Dawn, you want to go first?
I think it's the first one where you stomp the gas.
Stomp the gas? Okay. Any reason why you think that?
Just the way the wording is for that. I've never heard of that saying, but just the wording.
So you're thinking put on the iron means yeah. Okay. Got it. Dave, what do you think?
It means putting chains on the tires.
Yeah. What makes you think this?
Growing up in the snowy climate for the most part, in snow, a good set of snow tires would suit you fine. However, there were some people that there's a chance that I'm going to have to drive up, this, muddy mountain pass. And like, really? In Scranton? But the, so they would put chains on the tires, or they would have chains on the tires to go do that.
That would make sense, actually, Dave, because if you think about it, Iron City, the steel part of the country, that's pretty logical.
What do you think, Ben?
Well, I think three of them are plausible, but I kind of agree with the snow chains too, for no better reason than the fact that sometimes when I'm bored late at night, I'll turn on the old Ice Road Truckers reruns. Those are pretty amusing.
That's cool. Well, the correct answer is, in fact, putting chains on the tires. If you put on the iron, you're putting chains on your tires. That's right. Good job, you guys.
And do not do this in Atlanta. We have enough potholes as it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. They really rip up the street.
Oh, yeah.
And they're so tough to drive on. They are meant 100% for snow. I mean, come on. Have you ever driven on chains?
Oh yeah.
It's the minute you get off the, like, if you get on regular ground, you're like driving on gravel.
Yes.
It's like, oh, and the sound is awful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In Denver, when I spent some time in Denver, we had, studded tires aplenty there. And people will drive out around on their snow studs until springtime came. And you can hear them. They sounded different on the road, but at least they weren't jarring like chains are. So.
Yeah. Well, I think, if you live in a place or community where, there's even a reasonable amount of snow plowing, a steel belt or radial is going to be just fine for 90% of people's driving in the world. Exactly. And there are, my brother-in-law's one. He will drive way the hell up into the mountains in snow. To ski or hunt or snowmobile. Those are specialty cases, but then you build the time in. When you get back down, you take them back off.
Right. Exactly.
Now, if you want to get really fun, I'm aware that there's one of the wintertime hobbies up in the far northern states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, places like that. There are a lot of folks who will buy like old dirt bikes, for cheap. And sometimes they'll even buy several broken ones and make one good one out of them and have a Franken bike. And what they'll do is in the wintertime, they'll take them out on the frozen lakes and race them. And what they do for traction is they take a whole bunch of sheet metal screws, the little short, like quarter inch sheet metal screws, and screw those into the tread blocks on the tires. And it's a hoot and a half. I have a friend who's done it. She said it was just a blast. And one of the funny things too was that they put beer in coolers out there in the lakes to keep the beer from freezing. because it's an insulated box and it's out there in 20-30 below. If you want to get into frozen traction fun, that's one hell of a way to do it.
Do not do this if you're in Atlanta, and do not do this on a publicly serviceable road.
Because once you hit pavement, all those little screws are going to start coming out.
Yeah, and then they'll end up in my tire, and then I'll be very angry. Yeah,
and they'll hit pedestrians in the eye and stuff like that. It'll just be, and they'll make all this noise inside your fenders.
Right, I hate it when that happens. So,
yeah. Hey, nobody cool. in Minnesota, you got to do something to break up the ice fishing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey.
Oh, yeah. Hey, take off.
All right. Thanks, you guys. Good episode. This has been The Thing About Cars. Thank you as always for joining us. If you like what you hear, please visit us on Patreon, patreon.com/thethingaboutcars. We appreciate your support. And otherwise, just, you know, let us know how you're doing and let us know what's in store for your 2021 via our Facebook page. And we'll see you again with another episode in about a week. Stay safe. Hey, take care. Oh, yes, Dave.
I was going to say, hey, and if you love us, review us on iTunes. If you're not fond of us, you know, review. Wait, don't tell me on iTunes instead.
Thanks, you guys. Hope you're all staying safe. And I'll see you again for another episode in about a week.
Later.
Happy 2021.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.